for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In a blog posted last week, Dr. Andrew Weil said there was much to like in President Obama's health care reform speech, except it missed the root of the problem, the health care system itself. Now, in a new book, the best-selling author and director of the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine at the University of Arizona outlines a proposal to create a new culture of health and a complete transformation of medicine in this country. The title of his new book is Why Our Health Matters. And Dr. Weil joins me in the studio. I know many of you are his followers, his fans, and supporters. I look forward to hearing from you. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us by Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, sir. It's good to see
you. Good morning. Good to be here again.
Thank you. You've said that you're both encouraged and frustrated by President Obama's goals for health care. How so?
Well, first, I am enormously pleased that a president has really taken this on as a task. And I think the most important thing he said the other night was that he was not the first president to do this, but he was going to be determined to be the last. I mean, that's great. We have a terrific mess in this country. And if we don't do something about it, it's going to take us down completely economically. Even before the financial meltdown of last year, analysts were saying that escalating health care costs in this crisis had the potential to sink us economically. And that's absolutely true. I mean, if we head up to something like spending 20% of our gross domestic product on health care, we're doomed. So it's urgent to do something about this. Also, imagine how we look to the rest of the world. I mean, to the other developed countries of the world, that we have such an enormous percentage of our citizenry not covered. I mean, every other modern democracy realizes that it is an obligation of society to provide basic health care to all of its citizens. You know, we waste unbelievable amounts of money administratively by having such a fragmented system of billing. And the worst of it is we pay so much per capita on our health care, more than any other country by a long shot, and we have the worst health outcomes of any developed country. You know, we haven't gotten better health as a result of all this spending. So I think it's great that the president has taken this on. But I must say I'm very disheartened to see the level to which this debate has sunk. The vested interests that don't want things to change are incredibly powerful. And this is the pharmaceutical companies, the manufacturers of medical devices, and the big insurers. I mean, who doesn't want a public option here? It's the big insurance companies who are making out like bandits. And they are able to manipulate people into thinking that this is going to take things away from them, keep them from getting good care. That's very discouraging
but
to see.
You have seen, as I have, these town meetings across the country where people are raucous, where they hold up signs, where they insult the speaker. What's going on there?
I think they are being manipulated ultimately by these powerful vested interests. The people who, you know, I think what we must realize is that as dysfunctional as our system of health care is, it's generating vast amounts of money that are going into very few pockets. And the owners of those pockets have enormous influence over our legislators, over the media.
So there is the political reality that, as the president says, and some of his advisors have said, if he could start from scratch, he would do what many Americans want him to do. He would have a government plan. He would even perhaps have a single payer system.
But, Diane, yes.
But yes. The question is, the legislators
right.
and how you get
but
past
what I
it.
Would say is that all of this argument is not touching the real problem. I mean, the root of the problem is that health care in this country has become much too expensive. Now, why does it cost so much? It seems to me that the answers are, first, because we give little more than lip service to prevention, we are forced to deal with established disease, the great majority of which is lifestyle related and therefore preventable. So we don't have a healthcare system in this country. We have a disease management system.
But you can't legislate people being healthy.
No, but you can put resources and energy into health promotion and prevention. You know, I have a call to action which has 7 steps, and one of the things that I am really pressing for is to create an Office of Health Education within the Department of Education that would really have the funds and influence to stimulate innovative development of educational initiatives to teach kids from kindergarten on up what health is, why it's important to us, what are the major influences of lifestyle and health.
And just look there at what's happened in our schools with soft drink machines, with
physical education cut out, right.
So that kids don't even get outside the building.
So this is part of the root problem. Now, this is the first big piece, is that we aren't investing in health promotion and prevention. The second reason why healthcare is so expensive is that the kinds of interventions that we have come to favor are very dependent on technology, and that technology is inherently expensive. That includes pharmaceutical drugs. The fact is that physicians are not trained in a whole range of therapeutic options that work very well and don't cost very much. And that's everything from dietary change, use of dietary supplements, specific therapies like acupuncture, the whole range of mind-body therapies. I mean, and this is not woo-woo stuff.
Exactly.
It's not unscientific stuff.
Right.
You know, this is practical. These are practical techniques that can save us money and make people healthier, that can improve our health outcomes.
You know, having just had my own experience with the healthcare system, having broken my pelvis in the emergency room, first an x-ray showed nothing, but I couldn't walk. So then the very wise doctor said, we've got to do a CAT scan to see what's going on. And there showed the cracks. Now, there are people who would say, we're wasting money on CAT scans.
No, I would say that is appropriate use of medical technology. But on the other hand, how many cases do we see of people that, for as a first step in evaluating headaches, get an MRI, for example, or for knee pain, one of these fancy scans? And as you know, part of the problem is that in many cases, the facilities or physicians own these devices, and they make money from the use of them. So the decision to use these high-tech, expensive diagnostic machines is often driven by a profit motive, not by medical rationale.
So, Dr. Weil, if you could wipe out the entire system as it now stands, how would you begin to build from the ground up?
All right. First, I would really begin with medical education and medical training. And at the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine, one of our initiatives is developing a comprehensive curriculum in this new broadened system of medicine, and to have this be a required accredited part of residency training for all physicians, so that whether you're a dermatologist or a psychiatrist, you know, or a surgeon, you come out with knowing the basics of nutritional influences on health, mind-body interactions, the range of available therapies,
and so forth. Which too many of the medical schools say they don't have time to teach.
And this is certainly true in undergraduate education, but in residency it's possible to do this, and we're doing it now. So eventually it'll filter down to undergraduate medical education. So I think this is necessary, and it's not just physicians, it's pharmacists need to be trained in the use of dietary supplements and botanicals and all the things that are now in the world of health food stores rather than in pharmacies. Nurses need to be given a different role in the healthcare system.
They're disempowered
now, and they are vital links between, you know, I think we need to really forge better interactions between doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and patients.
Boy, were they wonderful when
wonderful.
I was in the hospital.
And it's, and
absolutely
it's, and it's
wonderful.
The shortage of nurses. This is one of the reasons why hospital care in this country has, the quality of it has declined so much. So that all has to be changed. And then, as I said, I would really get serious about prevention and health promotion. And this doesn't mean, you know, it's not telling people you have to eat this way, you have to do
this. Or
you
cannot.
You cannot. It's providing incentives and disincentives to help people make better choices. At the moment, I think that, you know, we have corporations given free rein to advertise the unhealthiest food to kids and make it look attractive. Did you know, I just found this out actually last night, that the Federal Trade Commission, which can regulate advertising based on whether it's truthful and fair, has been denied legislatively since 1981 from applying the Fairness Doctrine to advertising for kids. I didn't know that. I mean, that's awful. And this is clearly the power of special interests which have done this.
Well, you know, I think, and I've said this often, you could probably correlate the rise in the rate of obesity to the advertisements for food on television.
Absolutely. And you can also see this happening all over the world, where we are successfully exporting our kinds of food and our eating habits. So that has to change. You know, we have to, I think that corporations, government, individuals all have to pull together in the same direction if we're going to be a healthier society.
And as you know, Dr. Andrew Weil is the New York Times bestselling author of Healthy Aging. He now has a new book. It's titled Why Our Health Matters. Do join us, 800-433-8850. I look forward to hearing from you. Welcome back, and one of the most knowledgeable guests about health, preventive medicine, Andrew Weil, is with me. He's got a new book on why our health matters, and he calls it a vision of medicine that can transform our future. While politicians in this city, people around the country are arguing about financing. Not enough people are paying attention to what we as individuals can do to make ourselves healthier, to promote good health care in this country. Dr. Weil, if you could speak to President Obama, what would you say?
I think I would urge him to concentrate more on messages about health promotion and prevention, because it seems to me that these would be above the level of this nasty kind of partisan fighting that we see at the moment. And really, they go more to the root problems. That is, what can the federal government do to encourage people to make better choices in their lives about how they eat, how they exercise, how they handle stress, and so forth. I think that health is an individual responsibility, but it is up to our government to make things easier for us, not harder. For example, if you look at the influence of environment on health, it's very striking in this country when our government is faced with a choice between protecting public health and private interests. It almost always sides with private interests. That's much less true in Europe. And I think one reason is that the European governments are invested more in the health of their people because they're paying for their health care.
Give me an example.
Well, if you look at there was just a front page article in the New York Times about the deterioration of water quality in this country. You know, we have agencies that are supposed to be protecting us from this, and they haven't done it. I mean, that the legislation has been weakened. It's been not enforced. I think the whole subject of environmental health and medicine is another one that has been neglected in medical education. No, I got none of this in my education at Harvard Medical School. I was talking to a group of medical residents and students who came out to Arizona for a rotation with our center a few months ago, and I said I wanted to talk to them some about environmental health and medicine. And a woman in the group interrupted me and said, "Excuse me, I don't know what those terms mean." So this is a place we can start. If we had a medical profession that was really knowledgeable about environmental influences on health, they could stand up as a powerful social political force to counteract some of the pressure of the vested interests. By the way, another aspect of environmental health and medicine that I'd love to see us work on is the internal environments of our healthcare centers, which in some ways are some of the worst. First of all, hospitals are some of the worst polluters in the country. And also, the internal environments, I think, are inimical to health and healing. You know, if you tried to design an environment that most effectively thwarted the healing process, you could hardly come up with something better than
and
a modern hospital.
You know, it was the nurses who
yes.
said to me, while I was in the hospital, breathe deeply. Make sure you breathe deeply. Keep your legs moving. Keep your body working so you can ward off disease.
In many ways, nurses have more of this knowledge than physicians do, but they've been so disempowered in medical interactions that they don't get to express it. So I think that's a very important observation.
Absolutely.
By the way, we also desperately need more primary care physicians. You know, we have fewer primary care physicians than any other developed country. And by this,
why has this happened?
Well, I think it's logical. It's that specialized medicine pays more, and also there's more prestige attached to it. So that has to change, and an easy way to change this is another simple fix, is that the federal government could begin subsidizing the education of people going into primary care. You forgive student loans, for example. There has to be a way to level the playing field. There's very good research showing that even here in our country, in states that have more primary care physicians, health outcomes are better.
So faced with the kind of political realities that the president is dealing with, you know, you're sort of blindsided from that end of it before you can get to the kinds of things you're talking
true,
about.
True, but I think that by choosing some initiatives that, as I say, are above the political fray, things like encouraging more people to go into primary care medicine.
You would do that now.
I would do that now. These are simple fixes that we could apply now, and I think that would not get the kind of rancor that, you know, some of the other proposals do.
Now, if you had your druthers, would there be a single-payer plan in this country?
The amount of money wasted in this country administratively on health care is staggering, and it dwarfs the amounts spent in any other nation on earth. We could easily cover everybody in this country just by recouping the money lost in administrative costs.
By the insurance companies.
Right, and that would be solved at one stroke
so
if we had a single-payer system.
So are you saying you'd wipe out the insurance companies?
I think that they cannot be allowed to make the kinds of profits that they're now making. I think they have to be regulated much more tightly. I would also ask people to think about ultimately moving toward a nonprofit situation. Personally, I think medicine was never meant to exist in a for-profit system. And I think these past decades of wildly profit-driven medicine have been disastrous for both patients and physicians. Whether we could get there overnight, I don't know. But I think ultimately they'd like to see us move toward taking the profit incentive out.
And isn't that what President Obama is trying in increments?
Yes.
To at least move us away.
And I think this incremental change, realistically, this is what we are going
to
have to do. And even if, you know, doing something like eliminating the disqualification of people on the basis of preconditions, that would be a huge step. You know, it's an increment, but still, it would be a huge step toward improving our situation.
You're also recommending a new National Institute of Health and Healing at NIH.
You know, I think that part of my conception of how medicine could be is that the focus really would be on health and healing, not on disease management. It's an interesting exercise. If you look at the names of the institutes that make up NIH, they don't look like institutes of health. They're institutes of diseases and body parts.
Yeah.
You know, there's the National Heart Institute and the National Kidney and Allergy and so forth. Where's the National Institute of Health and Healing? That should be the centerpiece. You know, and what I would like to see a National Institute of Health and Healing do would be extensive research on the body's own innate mechanisms for maintaining health, for repair, for regeneration. I mean, this is where health begins. I think so few people that I meet have real confidence in their body's ability to maintain health and deal with all the challenges that you face. I'd like to increase that confidence in people, and doing research on it would be one way to do it.
You know, my doctor has been just totally amazed at how quickly I've been able to recover from this cracked pelvis. And at 72 years of age, he looked at me and said, "This is really remarkable." Well, I do Pilates and have done Pilates for years. So I think the core strength of my body has been there to help me heal.
So I think this idea should be instilled in kids at the earliest age. And
Absolutely.
This is something that the Office of Health Education could do. The body has a marvelous capacity. You're born with it to maintain health, to restore health. And as you go through life, it's up to you to figure out ways to protect and enhance that capacity.
We've got so many callers waiting.
Great.
I do want to go to the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Fernandina, Florida. Good morning, Andrea. You're on the air. Andrea, let's try that again. Andrea, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I sure can. Go right ahead.
Okay. Congratulations on your healing, Diane.
Thank you.
Dr. Weil, I want to personally thank you. Someone put the book Eating Well for Optimum Health in my hands 2 years ago. I started with the very small components of it and followed it, and as a result, I am 170 pounds lighter.
Yes.
When people talk to me about what I've done and the remarkable change that has occurred, I've told them about the book. And they are amazed at how simple the approach is. But to your point, if everyone could gain knowledge and education around the proper things to put in our body, we wouldn't have these problems. And I believe it is the cure-all for the system. I'm with you. But I wanted to say thank you so very much. You've changed my life.
Good to hear from you. And two things you said really stand out for me. One is that it was small, incremental changes. You didn't have to take on something globally and daunting. And I think that this is the way people really can change their lives in small steps. And you know, secondly, that it's not that hard. This is simple stuff. And if you get the information that we have about how the lifestyle choices you make influence your health, it's not that complicated. For instance, with food, if I could summarize everything I know about nutrition in one sentence, it's just stop eating as much as possible refined, processed, and manufactured food. It's that simple.
So that means canned foods, boxed foods, prepared
fast foods. And this, by the way, is the huge change. I'm sure you remember the same thing, Diane. When I was growing up in the 1940s and 50s, my family, we ate at least two meals together every day,
food
was cooked from scratch. Mm-hmm. The big change that's happened in America is the extent to which processed, refined, and manufactured food has replaced real food in people's lives. And I think the obesity epidemic and all of these chronic problems that we see correlate with that. It's a dramatic change.
Let's go now to Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Willen. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I just want to challenge a couple of things that have been said. One is that there's been a denigration of the town hall meetings by the major press. And again, on your show, I've gone to a couple of town hall meetings, and I wasn't instigated by anybody or any organization. But the point is, healthcare is very important to me, and my insurance is important to me. And I don't want to be in a government program. I don't want my insurance taken away or anything like that. And Obama wants to instate and the author wants a single-payer system, this is the goal to get there, and we are very happy. 85% of the people are happy with the insurance they have. And if you want to remake the insurance program for healthcare for 10 million people that do not have insurance at this point.
All right. First of all, I would say you should look at countries like Germany and Australia, which have both public and private options. There's a public program, and people can also choose to stay in their private programs. These systems work very well. So it doesn't have to be one or the other. It doesn't mean that your present insurance will be taken away from you.
And it's so interesting, Alan, because over and over, I've heard President Obama say, if you're happy with your own insurance, you're...
But by your own admission on this program and by Obama's statements, his goal is ultimately a single-payer system. This is the first step to a single-payer system. And you know it, and so does your author. And you both have expressed a desire for that type of system.
Willen, there are a great many people in this country like yourself who would not be in favor of a single-payer system. I do understand that. At the same time, there are many people in this country without any insurance at all who need some type of choice.
And I can't agree that so many people are satisfied with their health insurance.
He said 85%.
Yeah, I mean, the stories that you hear every day are horror stories of people who are denied claims, have to fight with their insurance companies, pay more and more for less and less. I don't see that kind of happiness.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Tallahassee, Florida. Good morning, Megan. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'm so glad to have you back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
I would like for the two of you to address the unseen cost of this expensive healthcare system. For instance, when my daughter was born in 2006, she had some serious medical issues, still does. We had a very good private insurance policy at that time. And even with that coverage, she would still have cost us literally tens of thousands of dollars out of pocket. So that we had to deliberately limit our income in order to qualify for Medicaid. Since then, we have been literally trapped in a cycle of poverty just to ensure that she gets the care she needs. And I'd like for you guys to speak about that.
I'm so sorry. How old is your child?
She's 3 years old now.
And can you give me an idea of what her problems are?
Well, her primary diagnosis is septo-optic dysplasia, which is a rare congenital disorder, which basically affects her eyes. She's legally blind. She also has pituitary dysfunction, so she's on full hormone replacement. She has epilepsy, and she has several other neurological disorders.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Let me just say that to go back to what I said at the beginning, the primary problem we have is how to lower healthcare costs. And the way we do that is by shifting energies in the direction of prevention and health promotion, and secondly, by breaking conventional medicine's dependence on high-tech interventions for everything. In a rare condition like this, you know, the full resources of technological medicine are necessary.
Absolutely.
But we are trying to use these interventions for everything that comes in the door. We cannot deliver that kind of medicine to everyone in this country. I think if we begin to really move in the direction of prevention and health promotion and train doctors to practice medicine in a broader, more cost-effective way, we save vast amounts of money, and then we can allocate resources more wisely from where they're needed.
Megan, thanks for calling. What about tort reform? The president has spoken about that.
Yeah, I'm strongly in favor of that. I don't know what percentage of waste defensive medicine constitutes, but it's big. And many doctors I know are very dismayed at what they see going on in emergency rooms and in clinics, that the incredible use, wastage of resources, doing of tests, doing medical procedures that are not dictated by medical rationale, but rather out of fear of lawsuits.
What is the average amount of malpractice insurance that doctors
I think it varies wildly
by specialty.
And in some high risks, you know, obstetrics, for example, is very high risk. They're vast sums. But worse than that is that the amount of money spent on, as I say, procedures and tests done just defensively, because doctors fear lawsuits, that could be changed by tort reform.
Andrew Weil, his new book is titled Why Our Health Matters. When we come back, more of your calls, your comments. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by NPR stations, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org, and by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a year after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, which marked the beginning of the global economic crisis, we consider how the financial industry has changed. And not changed. We talk with New York Times financial reporter and columnist Gretchen Morgenson. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And here's a message from Rosie on Facebook for Dr. Andrew Weil of the University of Arizona Medical School. She says a big cost saver for the prescription drug companies would be to stop expensive commercials on primetime TV. I think people who want Viagra, Cialis, and the various birth control medications know they want them. Your doctor should be the one advising you not a sales pitch on TV.
I couldn't agree more. The first step in my call to action is to ban direct-to-consumer advertising of pharmaceutical drugs. The only other nation in the world that allows this is New Zealand. This has been a disaster for medical practice in this country and an enormous boon for the pharmaceutical companies. There is absolutely no place for that. We should stop that immediately.
What about this case against Pfizer?
Well, you know, I could spend the whole time here talking about pharmaceuticals and the abuses of the companies. Pfizer paid a $2.3 billion settlement for falsely advertising a pain drug called Bextra for unapproved uses. First of all, I found it very interesting that this was reported on page 4 of the business section of the New York Times and not on the front page. I think that says something about the power of these companies. Also, the article mentioned that that settlement represented something like a few days of Pfizer's revenues, so an insignificant amount. The pharmaceutical drugs have the highest markup of any commodity on the American marketplace. And the companies justify this by saying they have to spend so much on research and development. The amount they spend on research and development is dwarfed by the amount they spend on marketing and promotion. The efficacy of these drugs is greatly exaggerated, and safety concerns are often minimized or concealed. But I would, you know, say that the drug companies are just capitalizing on a mindset that is so deeply rooted in both patients and doctors that the only legitimate way to treat disease is by giving drugs. Where did that idea come from? You know, and this is something I'd like to see change, and this is part of what I call integrative medical education, that is to make doctors aware that for many common conditions, there are alternatives to pharmaceutical drugs that you can try. If they don't work, you can always try the drugs. But I think we would all be healthier if we used fewer pharmaceuticals.
Here's another Facebook message from Catherine. She says, T.R. Reid of the Washington Post claims that the same MRI that costs $98 in Japan costs about $1,500 in the U.S. Why? He also says the Japanese still make a profit at this price.
Very interesting. I would also say it's interesting to check on the differential in prices of pharmaceutical drugs in other countries, that the prices in the U.S. are much higher than for the same drugs sold in other countries. So these companies are making greater profits here.
All right. To Harvard, Illinois. Good morning, John.
Yes, hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Thanks. I'm glad you're feeling better, too, I hope.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to point out that back, what we concentrate on in this country, we concentrate on cancer cures. And back in the early 70s, when Richard Nixon, of all people, was starting to do a war on cancer, all the doctors said, well, it's cancer prevention. You got to stop putting chemicals into the environment and other causes. And, you know, the special interest said, well, hey, you're not going to do that. So they decided it's easier, it's more palatable to try and cure the cancer than to prevent it in the first place. And that's an example of how we could be saving billions of dollars. You know, we see that with, like, these plastic bottles where they're trying to take the plasticizer out of them now. You know, we should have been doing this 30 years ago. And it's insane that we spend so much money trying to cure these cancers when it would cost, you know, 10 cents on the dollar to prevent them in the first place.
Well, of course, we should be doing both. I mean, for people who have cancer, they should get the best treatments available. But it is absolutely true that we know a great deal about ways of reducing risks of cancer. And this is everything from maintaining normal weight, and that's especially important for the hormonally driven cancers like breast cancer. We know that high meat diets promote prostate cancer in men that are susceptible to that. We have a tremendous amount of information about how lifestyle choices influence cancer risk. Of course, the number one is smoking.
Let's go exactly to that subject to Cindy in Knoxville, North Carolina. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning, Diane. Yes, I've been a RN for 25 years, and about half of that has been in home health, taking care of chronic smokers and diabetics who are woefully noncompliant, who, despite all teaching, want to continue to smoke and go to the ICU when they get pneumonia so that they can be saved to come home back on oxygen and smoke again. also diabetics. I've had one woman who had lost both her legs, her arm, three fingers on the other hand, had a horrible decubitus, and was had been put into an assisted living center for permanent care, and still we were getting calls from them because she refused to be non-compliant, or refused to be compliant. These people are costing society, and they say, well, it's my right. Well, you know, it's not society's right to pay for them. And there are people who may be inconceivable to most of us who get a lot of psychological feedback from being ill. And if these people refuse to comply, they need to have to start to be hit in their pocketbooks for co-pays to make them comply. There are people that have to be forced to do it.
So what I would say to this is that the best approach would be to prevent this from happening in the first place. Tobacco in the form of cigarettes is the most addictive drug we know. It's right up there with crack cocaine.
And look at these young kids who are still out there smoking.
Okay, so you want to stop that before it starts. You know, you really have to make people aware that this is something you shouldn't even try once, because if you try it, the chances are that you're going to get hooked on it, and it's a very tough thing to break. And with type 2 diabetes, which is the common form, you know, which is becoming epidemic in our country now.
You do lose limbs.
Absolutely. And this is something that's completely preventable. Completely preventable in most cases by maintaining normal weight, by avoiding the kinds of foods that promote this, by getting proper physical activity. So this is where if we really got serious about prevention and health promotion, we could stop there. Once you're at the other end of it with these end stage cases that
very
are costing
difficult.
Us so very difficult.
Very.
So this is a perfect example of why we should be concentrating.
Thanks
up
front. For calling, Cindy. Let's go now to Fredericksburg, Texas. Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning, Diane. As you can probably gather, I'm from England, so I see the other side of health service. I heard mentioned that if you added up all the administrative costs of the insurance companies, that would pay for health care here. If that's a true statement, that's stunning. And I just wonder how we can get that out to the general population, because so many people don't listen to you. And if that's true, we should be furious with the insurance companies for causing so much cost to the nation for health care.
Good. I want to see more people furious, because I think, you know, I don't think we can rely on politicians for change here. I think they are too beholden to the vested interests. And I think that the only way we'll get these really fundamental changes is if more people out there become aware of the situation and become angry about it. We should be furious that we don't have the health care we deserve. And we should be furious about the amount of money that's now wasted in these administrative costs, about the amount of money going in at just outrageous profits to the CEOs of the big insurers, to the pharmaceutical companies, the manufacturers of medical devices. I would love to see people, more people get it and become angry and then change the political balance.
And Carrie, you've now expressed your anger to about 2.5 million people across the country, and maybe you have started something new. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Kings, Illinois. Good morning, Suzanne. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I am so honored and a little nervous because I admire you so much.
Oh,
thank
you.
For your show.
Thank you.
I've been a nurse for 27 years, and I have a sister a nurse for 47 years. And it's interesting when the two of us will come together. She's worked in a unit where most people have Medicare or Medicaid. She works coronary care. So as an emergency room nurse, I see every day for many, many years the crisis. And I keep saying our system's going to, you know, cave in on itself if something isn't done. So I'm extremely thankful for your guest today. And I feel like I'm in a battle against disease and suffering. And I feel like I now am causing suffering. I feel like when I have patients every day uninsured or being dropped off the insurance, co-workers that are nurses who once had wonderful coverage worrying how they will get treatment. I feel like there's so many people that are being listened to that are not people who have any experience or have any knowledge, and I feel like they just don't understand, as my sister oftentimes won't understand where I'm coming from, having not seen
what I've seen, you know, on a nightly basis. And I just am very thankful to you, Mr. Weil, and for all the guests you've had, Diane, on both sides. I listen, and I wish I could do more, but I definitely talk to people on a daily basis and will try to help people understand, you know.
I think you're doing a great job, Suzanne. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a very touching comment, and I to do what you're doing and tell more people about it, because you know people need to know the realities of healthcare in this country from people who are actually doing it.
Let's go to Weston, Connecticut. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for getting better and coming back.
Thank you.
The question I have is 2 years ago, my wife had an operation. I signed all kinds of papers that said I was responsible for balance billing. I'm retired military. The bill came in at $144,000. I paid $3,000 because that's what I have to pay for my military coverage. And They and the military paid $26,000. Then the doctors and the hospital wrote off the balance. But I was potentially liable for $125,000. And who pays the $144,000, or is that just a bogus figure?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't know the answer to it, but I can tell you that in many cases, the true costs of health care are concealed. That if you pay a small copay for something, somebody is paying the rest of that, and we're all ultimately paying for it. So the actual cost of health care may not be apparent.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email on that very subject from John in Cleveland, who works for an insurance carrier. He says, "We are not the problem. The problem is the providers billing exorbitant amounts for services." Just a few minutes ago, he says, "I processed a claim for a simple lab test. The provider billed us $295 for the test. We only paid him $19, which our company considered fair compensation. The rest is written off because the contract they signed with us and the patient had no liability to pay the remainder. I think the fees providers charge should be capped to reasonable rates."
A good suggestion, and this is one of the many kinds of abuses of the fragmented system that we now have.
So if you are to move your ideas forward, you've written this book, you're talking to people around the country today, what's next?
I really think we need a grassroots movement out there. You know, we really need people to become informed about the situation, to understand how desperate this crisis is, that it has the potential to sink us economically, how out of step we are as a nation with the developed nations of the world in not taking care of our whole population, and also for people to realize that there is better medicine that we could have if doctors and other health professionals are trained to think about health and medicine in a much broader way.
And here is David in Lebanon, Ohio, on that very point. Good morning to you, sir. You're on the air.
Morning and welcome back.
Thank you.
Doctor, just really a kind of a point emphasizing the pharmaceutical relationship with doctors. I came down with ulcerative colitis about 10 years ago, and my doctor immediately prescribed rather expensive Acecal and mercaptopurine, and I had done some research and found out that zinc, very inexpensive, was sometimes shown to be very helpful as well. And I've been on zinc along with everything else. And when I mentioned to him about the zinc, he went, "Oh yeah, that's probably a pretty good idea too."
So he did not hear about that in his medical education. We want to make sure at the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine that doctors of the future hear about that in their medical education and other treatment options. And again, I would just ask you, how did we fall into the habit of thinking that pharmaceutical drugs are the answer to everything?
Well, here may be part of the answer. An email from Bernadette in Laconia, New Hampshire. Could Dr. Weil please expound on the fact that medical schools in this country are heavily subsidized by major drug companies, hence physicians writing prescriptions for patients instead of teaching and being taught preventive medicine?
Right, and so are the medical journals heavily subsidized. And this is one reason why these drug trials are reported that the way that they are, even when often the science behind them is bad. One of the things that I've called for in the book is to have the federal government create an objective compendium of information about pharmaceutical drugs. You know, most doctors, when they want to know about a drug, turn to the physician's desk reference. This is an industry publication. It is not objective. We need an objective source that people can look to, you know, which really portray drugs as they are.
And with the true side effects that they do.
Absolutely.
Dr. Andrew Weil has been my guest for this hour. I know that many of you feel, as he does, that we need to concentrate more on health than we do on sickness. Andrew Weil, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
His book is titled Why Our Health Matters. And I thank you for listening. Have a great day. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.